This morning, as you know, we have two cases that are consolidated, United States versus Diaz and United States versus Lopez. Mr. Zip is representing the government on both cases, and in the Diaz case, Ms. Hanover is representing the defendant, and in the second case, Lopez, Mr. Marks is representing the defendant. If it's all right with you, since Mr. Marks is going to get 18 minutes, and if you will indulge us, Ms. Hanover, why don't we take the Lopez case first rather than starting with the two-minute one and come back? Is that all right with you?
Sure, that's fine. Thank you.
I can't hear you. You got your...
Can you hear me now?
Now we can, yeah. Is that all right with you?
Yes, absolutely. That's fine, Your Honor. Thank you.
Great, very good. So we'll start. We realize this is all part of one argument because it deals with the same statutory construction issue. But we'll start with the case of United States versus Lopez. Mr. Zip, you want to start in the argument for the United States, please? And I assume you'll deal with the issue in terms of both cases. But we proceed. And I'll let us know, do you want to save any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, we'll try to help you, but keep your eye on the clock, if you will, please.
Yes. May it please the court, Daniel Zip on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, this court should interpret the safety valve provision of 3553F to provide for a disjunctive set of criminal history requirements. Although we recognize that the word and is most commonly used in the conjunctive, that reading in this case would lead to a number of concerns. First and foremost, it would violate the well-established principle that statutory interpretation that legislative enactments should not be read in a manner that renders their provisions mere surplusage.
Mr. Zip?
Yes.
Before we get there, I have a couple of questions because you admit that it would defy the common meaning of and, or goes against the plain and common meaning of and, correct?
Correct.
Seems like you agreed with that in the brief. It also would seem to ignore the structure of 3551F1 as a conjunctive negative proof, correct?
That is correct as well, yes.
All right. It seems like it would also ask us to disregard Congress's legislative drafting manual and what it states specifically in the drafting manual of how an and should be interpreted in the same context that it is here. Is that correct?
That's also correct, Your Honor.
All right, and then it also would go against the canon of consistent usage, giving support of and similar meaning, not just throughout the sentence, throughout the statute, but throughout the sentence, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so it seems like there's kind of a hill to climb here for you.
Certainly.
And you say that by reading it by and not by or, it would create some concerns, but doesn't it need to cause absurd results? And my question for you is, absurd results in defying common sense the same standard in your view, or is that two different standards? And do you think you reached that high bar of absurd results?
Your Honor, I guess the response would be yes, all four of those points you mentioned weigh against our interpretation, but the law of this court is clear that statutory interpretation is a holistic endeavor, and there are a number of what we believe to be stronger canons of statutory interpretation that weigh against the conjunctive interpretation.
Counsel, excuse me, I know you would want to continue on this, but you say that our case law suggests that statutory interpretation is a holistic endeavor?
Yes.
What case or cases do you cite to that effect?
It's a Supreme Court case, but it's Coons versus Buick Pontiac. Statutory construction is a holistic endeavor, is the quote.
That's interesting. I wonder if Justice Gorsuch would feel that way. He's a textualist. If anybody is a textualist, aren't you asking us to violate that manner of construing statutes?
No, Your Honor. And I think to go back to the first point I was making, even looking purely at the text of the statute, under the rule against surplusage, you can see that a construing and in the conjunctive in this case would render one third of the language that Congress added to be without meaning out of the gate, without even looking at legislative history or any external sources. Anytime you had a defendant who had a 3-point prior offense and a 2-point violent offense, they would necessarily have more than 4 criminal history points.
Let's say all that's true, and I do agree with the way you're interpreting that, but isn't that Congress's fault? They wrote this. We didn't write it. You're suggesting we need to perform a verbal contortionist action by rewriting this statute. Is that our role?
No, Your Honor, and we're not asking, well, maybe it's semantics, but we're not asking the court to rewrite the statute. We're asking, this court has...
You're asking us to interpret and to mean or.
Right.
That's and, a rewriting, and, is it not?
Our point is simply that for the last 150 plus years, starting with the United States versus Fisk case and continuing all the way up until the Confederated Tribes case of last year, this court has repeatedly recognized that on this particular issue of interpreting and or, that those two words, as odd as it may seem to people in the sort of non-statutory interpretation world, those two words are often used virtually interchangeably and with a certain laxity that asks this court repeatedly to do what we're asking it to do and to interpret the word and in the disjunctive if the other canons of statutory interpretation support that reading.
What is the best case that you would cite for the government's position that in this case we ought to interpret the word and to mean or?
I would say the court's decision just last year in the Confederate Tribes versus Yakima. The court in that case interpreted the word and in the disjunctive to mean or, and it did so for one reason only. It said that only one interpretation of that word and is plausible because only one gives meaning to every word in the statute. The same is true here. Only by interpreting the word and to mean or does that first subsection that Congress added have any meaning. Otherwise, if they're all read together, there's no reason to include a 4-point requirement at the outset.
Counsel, perhaps I'm jaundiced, having worked a couple of years for the Senate in legislative drafting on a committee long ago, but isn't it quite plausible that the reason you have the statute the way it is that people said, well, we don't want violent offenders, so they put in the two-point violent part, and then somebody says, well, we don't want a big offense, they put in the 3-point offense, and then we don't want somebody with a whole bunch of them, and they put in the 4-point criminal history, and this nobody sat down and made this, in my view, rather abstruse surplusage argument, because what you've got is people wanted to loosen things up. They clearly wanted some people out, and then they came up with this slightly strange amalgam with what we have here, but we have to read what we've got. If I could, let me follow up on myself. I'm sorry. The best thing for you, as I read it, is the contemporaneous, what I call the contemporaneous construction. That is, you make a point about this bullet points from the Committee on the Judiciary. You have the Sentencing Commission's write-up, probably from some staffer. And you have these district court cases, all of which people act as though it's an or. Okay? So I'm kind of with you there. But are any of these ones where people faced up to the issue? That is, the things that you put in on those points seem to me to be pretty strong, but they're only suppositions. Do you have anything where somebody before now has faced up to the issue and taken your side?
Other than the district court and the Adame case, no. And we acknowledge that the legislative history in this case is not the strongest in the world. We have sort of a few statements from the senators on the floor that describing this as a modest change and one that would apply to nonviolent offenders. And then, as you mentioned, the sort of summary from the Judiciary Committee. But our argument is not primarily that the legislative history wins the day in this case. I think it fully supports our reading, but our primary two arguments are, as I mentioned, that reading it in the conjunctive would render the first subsection as mere surplusage, and then more broadly, that reading it in this manner is simply illogical and absurd and would defy common sense.
Well, let me ask you this, that it sounds like the government seems to be conceding that the statute is, by your reading, ambiguous. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think.
Okay, if it's ambiguous, then why wouldn't the rule of lenity control, and we construe it in favor of the defendants in these cases?
Well, I think that's what the district court did below, but I don't think that that is an appropriate use of the rule of lenity. This court, or the Supreme Court in Abramski, said that that rule only comes in to play if there's grievous ambiguity or uncertainty in the statute, and if after applying the other canons of statutory interpretation, the court must simply guess at what Congress intended here. The mere possibility of articulating a narrow construction doesn't make the rule of lenity applicable here. So in our view, the rule only comes into play at the very end of the process. If after consulting the rule against surplusage and the rule against absurdity and consulting the legislative history, if at the end of the day, the court has to simply throw up its hands and guess as to what is meant here, that's when the rule of lenity would apply.
But if we get there, I mean, for example, you cite what the Senate Judiciary Committee summary did, but that referred to a different version of the bill than what was ultimately enacted. So if we get through all of this and we find that none of the canons really solves the problem, do you agree that in that case it is ambiguous and then we apply the rule of lenity?
If the court finds that the statute at the end of the process is grievously ambiguous and that has to simply guess at what Congress meant, then yes, that's when the rule of lenity would come into play.
Let me ask you, because you focus a lot on this three-point of violent offense and whether or not it violates the canon against surplusage. Diaz argues that a three-point violent offense can satisfy subsections B and C under 3553F, but not satisfy subsection A, more than four criminal history points, making A not superfluous. So you argue that that can't be the case, from what I understand, because the two-point violent offense includes a prior sentence only between 60 days and 13 months. Am I understanding you correctly?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Where is the exact phrase two-point violent offense in the sentencing guidelines? I don't think it's there. I mean, 4A1.1B says you add 2 points for each prior sentence of imprisonment of at least 60 days not counted in A. And then 4A1.1A says you add 3 points for each prior sentence of imprisonment exceeding 1 year and 1 month. Wow. Well, I understand your reading of a two-point offense.
It's the commentary to 4A1.1. It makes the two-point and three-point offenses mutually exclusive, essentially. What the commentary to the second, to the two-point offense says is that it's any offense that's more than 60 days but does not qualify under subsection A, meaning that it's not more than 13 months and a day.
But 4A1.1 never mentions the phrase two-point violent offense. The Senate Judiciary Committee bullet point summary on that, the one that you cite, found on, I think it's at ER 153, disagrees with your own interpretation of a two-point violent offense. It says, a bullet point summary explains a two-point violent offense as follows: violent offenses with sentences of at least 60 days. And I'm just wondering, doesn't that interpretation make sense here when you consider that section 4A1.1 in context? Because it seems like it's meant to count the criminal history points for the sentencing guideline calculation and not count twice the same sentence under 4A 1.1B and A.
I think that's our argument, is that it would be impossible to have a violent offense that met the definition of two-point offense and also at the same time met the definition of three-point offense. If you look at the commentary, it says an offense of at least 60 days not counted in 4A 1.1A. So
but there can be overlap under the safety valve. Otherwise, the disjunctive interpretation of 3553F1's and a five-year sentence of imprisonment will not satisfy the two-point offense. That seems odd, doesn't it?
It does, and that supports our argument. I think if you look at what the actual 3553F language says, it's two-point violent offense as defined under the sentencing guidelines. So then if you refer to the guidelines, they, in the commentary, say that a two-point offense is limited to this 60-day to 13-month window. And that leads to the absurdity of the conjunctive interpretation.
But your reading also leads to odd results. It seems like, because then you would be excluding the people who are, or you're only including the people from 60 days to 13 months. I'm not sure.
Once you have a disjunctive reading, then it makes sense that that category of 60 to 13 month defendants, if anyone who had even a 60 month violent offense, would be precluded from safety valve. And then similarly, someone with a 3-point offense would be precluded, or four or more. Each of the factors that Judge Boggs just mentioned earlier that sort of focus on recidivism, one focus on violence, one focus on more serious felony, each of those independently would preclude relief. It's only by reading them all together into the same defendant that it leads to the absurd result.
Well, how do you square your view with the First Step Act's purpose of helping low-level, which I think you agree, low-level nonviolent defendants, with excluding defendants like Lopez from the safety valve relief, I guess?
Even under the disjunctive language, it does provide a modest expansion of the criminal history requirements. For many years, we've operated here in a world where even having, even being on probation or having 2 1-point offenses would have precluded you. This expands it modestly so that someone, other than someone with a 3-point offense, a 2-point violent offense, or a 4 total criminal history points, not counting 1-point offenses, that's a fairly significant expansion, even in the disjunctive.
Well, it seems, assuming Congress, you know, did not target defendants like Lopez, because you're saying, you admit, I guess Lopez would not be, you know, even though he committed a vandalism charge, was convicted of vandalism charge some, you know, when he was 22, over 10 years ago. You don't think that's the kind of person that would have been, they would have been contemplating relief for?
I think it was a vandalism offense, but he served 16 months for it. It scores within the guidelines, and it's a 3-point offense. So he's certainly.
How about a defendant who pleads guilty to selling one marijuana cigarette to another? In your view, did Congress mean to exclude that person from safety valve relief when it amended, you know, 3553F1 in 2018? Because that would result in a 13-month sentence.
Oh, if it resulted in a 13-month sentence?
It would result in a 13-month sentence. So if you go to Alabama, Missouri, or Mississippi, it would result in a 13-month sentence.
When you answer Judge McGee's question, I just want to point out you're down to 2 minutes. Do you want to reserve the rest of your time after you answer the question?
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to reserve the rest of the time. And yes, it's hard to imagine a single marijuana cigarette resulting in a 13-month sentence. But if that did, in whatever district it would be, that would fall within the disjunctive language.
But That also is the odd, that's another odd result from your reading. And I know you're questioning the odd result from the reading in the conjunctive, but that's an odd result in the disjunctive. And I'm just having a hard time, understanding or believing that Congress got together after years of discussing criminal justice reform, modified the safety valve while repeatedly saying on the Senate floor it would give district courts discretion to avoid unfit sentences, or, and then for some reason not allow district courts give safety valve relief for a vandalism conviction or a conviction of selling one's marijuana cigarette some time ago.
I guess my only response would be that still is a significant expansion. On those unusual facts, it doesn't seem right. But
with Judge Smith's permission, if I could
please
ask.
Go ahead.
Is it really a significant expansion? I mean, this all of the focus is on F1, but you still have all the other. I mean, you don't have to. A judge doesn't have to go below the mandatory minimum. They can still go above the mandatory minimum. And it's this one statutory provision. There's still the other provisions that take into consideration, all of the safety valve factors. This is just one of the safety valve factors, but you still can look at F2, F3, F4, and F5, which I think would also eliminate any violent offenders. So I'm just wondering if we're too hyper-focused on this when you're considering the modest reduction in your argument.
Your Honor, and certainly there would be many defendants who still wouldn't qualify, but I think the focus of this argument has to be on the language that Congress did amend and what they changed. And all they changed in this case was the criminal history requirements. And our point ultimately is not that it's, that we have any sort of policy disagreement with them expanding it, or that that they should have expanded it less. Our point is simply that if you look at the three subsections that they added, it's not logical to conclude that they would have expanded it in the manner that this disjunctive reading or conjunctive reading would apply, that the safety valve would only, the safety valve would be ineligible only to those defendants who happen to fit this sort of haphazard collection of violent, nonviolent sentences of certain lengths. So ultimately, yes, I think that to answer your original question, an expansion from merely a more than 1 point criminal history requirement to eliminate defendants who have 3 or more points for a more serious felony that they served more than 13 months in prison was the modest change that Congress was attempting, not the sort of haphazard extension that would result from a conjunctive reading.
Okay, I'll give you a couple of minutes of rebuttal after your colleagues finish, because we've taken a little bit beyond the normal time. Let's now hear from Mr. Marks. And of course, Mr. Marks, you and Ms. Hanover are going to be dealing with some of the same issues. I don't know whether you coordinated, but if not, we're looking forward either way. So let's hear from Mr. Marks for 18 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. Michael Marks, Federal Defenders of San Diego. And I will be speaking on behalf of both Mr. Lopez and Mr. Diaz for the 18 minutes that I have. This provision is, I think the government has all but conceded, is unambiguous. The plain language of the statute, the natural reading, is conjunctive. The only reading that's consistent with the rest of the safety valve provision and the rest of 3553A, or 3553, is conjunctive. And so let's start with the plain language. As the government admits, the natural reading is a conjunction. The rest of the statute, 3553F, the safety valve provision, is written with the exact same structure, an introductory phrase, a number of subsections, separated by semicolon, joined by and. Clearly, this court has held that part of the provision is conjunctive.
Counsel, can I just as a matter of clarification.
Sure.
Did you say that the government has all but conceded that the statute is unambiguous, or that it is ambiguous? I understood the latter.
Well, I think it's important to think about what they are saying is ambiguous. I think that they have conceded that the natural reading of this statute is unambiguous. They have never suggested in the briefing or today that there is a natural reading of this language that is disjunctive, or that there's somewhere else in the statute that you can look that uses and as a disjunctive, or where they, you know, every time in 3553 that they use or, it is in fact disjunctive. So that's, there's no ambiguity there. And I think I would look to what Justice Gorsuch said. Your Honor, you noted his influence earlier. He made clear in Bostock recently that these extratextual concerns, the canons of construction, they are there to clarify ambiguous language, but they are not there to create ambiguity where none exists. And it's interesting that the government cited Coons earlier and said this is a holistic approach, but this is what Coons said. It says, a provision that may seem ambiguous in isolation is often clarified by the remainder of the statutory scheme. So the idea is that if the government can say, look, naturally read, this could go either way, then we agree, you get to these other steps and you try and figure out through the other statutory construction norms or perhaps extratextual concerns like legislative history, which of these two equally plausible readings is the one that Congress intended. But they've never actually proposed that there's another reading that makes sense when you just read the plain language.
But can you, Mr. Marks, address Mr. Zipp's argument that this was meant to only to be a modest increase, and so to read and in the conjunctive, defies that modest sort of relief of judicial discretion?
Yeah, there's a number of reasons why we don't think this the statute is absurd, and why this is. I don't know exactly what Senator Leahy meant by modest, but look, the provision could have been modified to essentially eliminate safety valve, but it left four of the five subsections intact, made no changes, and as to this one subsection, it certainly made more people eligible. That was the very point. But really all it did is it shifted the focus of safety valve eligibility to the person's conduct in the instant charge defense and said, to the extent we're going to bar people because of their past conduct having nothing to do with this offense, we're going to leave that up to the judges. So we're going to only preclude people based on their past conduct if they have the most aggravated, most serious criminal history. Counsel,
if you take your reading, the easiest one is that a person who doesn't have a two-point violent offense, he can have criminality out the wazoo, and he still gets the benefit of this. Is that not correct? I mean, he can be Bernie Madoff and have defrauded people of zillions and have all the criminal history points and all of the three-point offenses you want if he just robbed them with a fountain pen instead of a six-gun, as Woody Guthrie said. Is that modest?
It is, and the reason is that the if a person, remember, we're talking about eligibility for safety valve here. We're not talking about the ultimate sentence that a person receives. So in the case of somebody who has a particularly aggravated criminal history, going to have two, well, and if the offense is particularly bad itself, the district judge has the discretion to sentence at a much higher level above the mandatory minimum.
Yeah, he always has that. I mean, that's a kind of a fail-safe argument, but clearly, if you go through the legislative history, Congress did not want to give judges unlimited discretion. There was an earlier version that said something about the judge could find the criminal history overstated, and that was taken out, I believe. So that's kind of a make-weight argument. Let me give you one other question, which is your argument on textualism is very strong. My question is, why is it that until really now, everybody just acted as though it was or? The bullet point summary, the sentencing commission, which granted was staff, but they're relatively smart people, and quite a lot of district court cases And the Manzo case, granted it was very brief, but that's some smart Ninth Circuit judges saying things that are completely saying that it's or, that any one of the three knocks you out. Is it just that you guys were smarter than everybody else before? Or is there some way, the same question I asked the other side is, did anybody ever face up to this until Adame?
No one did. And I, the best explanation I have for the inconsistency between how people applied the statute and how it actually reads is that perhaps the intuitive gut response, based on the fact that we've all practiced in a world where safety valve was pretty strict for a long time, is that it wasn't meant to be as expansive as in fact it reads. But as all three of the panel have pointed out today, what is at issue is what it says. And it clearly on its face makes my client, Mr. Diaz, eligible. And to the extent I want to talk a little bit about the kind of sky is falling argument that the government's making, Judge Boggs. That in Adame, that was a District of Idaho case, that court said, gave the same example that Mr. Zip did in his briefing, which is person has five previous convictions for drug offenses. They're looking at they're a career offender looking at a 25-year mandatory minimum. They say, this is absurd. How could this person be eligible for the safety valve? I went back and I calculated the guidelines for that person. The base offense level is 30 years to life. So in order for that person to even under the guidelines get back down to the mandatory minimum, the judge has to agree on certain adjustments or departures, or at least convince the defendant has to convince the judge that a variance is appropriate. So those sorts of cases where somebody might be included in eligibility in a way that Congress would say, well, that's not really the people who we want to be eligible. Those people aren't getting probationary sentences. What would be absurd, and I think the problem that Congress was trying to fix, was certainly the state of things beforehand, where somebody just by virtue of being under probation, but never having spent a day in jail before, could be precluded from eligibility and subject to a mandatory minimum. And we think also, to the extent that you're going to miss people on the edges, that the margins might be over or under inclusive, I think that Congress in expanding safety valves certainly wanted to include people like Mr. Lopez and Mr. Diaz, whose criminal history is not so aggravated that they should be ineligible for a sentence under the mandatory minimum. Well, perhaps saying, look, maybe we're gonna make some people eligible that have really extended criminal histories, but at least in that case, the judge will have the discretion to fix it. When you say somebody is subject to a mandatory minimum, that means the judge cannot fix it no matter what they want. And I think the clear purpose of Congress, the only thing we can be sure of in terms of the legislative history, given that it is so scant, they didn't really show their work, is that they meant to expand safety valve. They meant to include more people, and our reading does that.
What about some of our case? I think the case that Mr. Zip referred to was Confederate Tribes and Bands of Yakima Nation versus Yakima City. How do you reconcile that with the reading of and there as or versus here?
Sure. In all of the cases that the government cites, so it's Yakima and Lumbermen's Council, and there's a few others. None of them involve this negative list of prohibitions. None of them. They all include kind of an affirmative list where they say in connection with A and B, or involving A and B, or this means A and B. And that is a situation where in the English language, unfortunately, and can sometimes have a conjunctive, but sometimes have a disjunctive meaning. None of those cases suggest that merely by using the word and, Congress has created a per se ambiguous statute. That's clearly not the case. I agree with Mr. Zip that you read the whole provision. So it's not just the word and may not convey a particular meaning, but certainly in context of the provision, it can mean something. And here, as the government has said, when you read it naturally, it unambiguously says there's a conjunction. And so Yakima, again, was, the court retains jurisdiction in cases involving non-Indian defendants and non-Indian victims. So it was unclear. Do you mean both have to be non-Indian or just one? And what the court said, and this came to the same conclusion that the Sixth Circuit has said, which is if only one of these two plausible readings of an ambiguous statute makes sense, then you go with that. But generally, you don't take the countertextual argument to fix some problem that comes only after you read this unambiguous statute. If I could, I know there were a lot of questions about the superfluity argument. I want to make two points about that. First, given that the statute reads plainly in the conjunctive, I think the fact that there is overlap really doesn't get the government very far. I think that the kind of statutory analysis is done once you find that the language means what it says. So I don't think the fact that there is that even if you find that it's superfluous would mean that you have to reject or even could reject the plain meaning of the statute. But it's important to recognize what the government's attack is. They are saying that our reading of the statute is superfluous, and that's simply not the case. As Mr. Zip said, he said if once you look at this statute disjunctively, the way the government wants to read it, then it has this problem in Part C of only referring to two-point offenses. But what you have to do when you're saying our reading is superfluous is take it at its face. We read it to be conjunctive. We read Part C to include both two- and three-point offenses. Under that reading, there is nothing superfluous about Part A. Now, I understand the government's attack. They say, look, but the real problem then isn't that it's superfluous, it's that you're including three-point offenses, not just two. And my response to that is this. We know that this provision is targeted at identifying only the most aggravated criminal history. Our argument is something today maybe about where to draw that line or where did Congress intend to draw that line, but that's clearly the intent, is to identify the most aggravated history and say those people, unlike others, will not be eligible for a sentence under the mandatory minimum. It makes no sense. It is truly absurd to say that Congress would include people who had a sentence for the same offense that got a sentence of 60 to, say, 13 months. But then the same offense, you get more time than that, and that doesn't have any effect on your eligibility for safety valve. That's absurdity, and we would suggest that that's absurdity, the absurdity doctrine applied correctly. Because it's not about identifying particular instances here and there that might be unexpected or unfair in the eyes of anybody. The question is, does it have a facial problem? And it makes no sense that in every single application of Part C, a person would be precluded from safety valve if they got, say, 8 months, but would be not precluded from safety valve with a sentence of 10 or 20 years. That facially makes absolutely no sense. So that can't be the reading. And I think it's also supported. The language of that statute actually identifies a base. I'll use one example. I just recently put in my MCLE time, and the bar website in California, I noticed this when I was preparing for argument, says all California lawyers must complete 25 hours of MCLE every 3 years. It didn't say must complete at least 25 hours, but of course that's how I understood it. I wouldn't have been upset if I had 26 or 30 hours. Luckily, I had more than 25 hours, but sometimes we pick out a number, but we mean it to say at least. And I think that is the usage clearly under a Part C that Congress intended. And that's because it just simply would make no sense to say that we want to include an 8-month conviction, but not a 20-year conviction. That can't possibly be the correct reading. I still have time. I'm happy to answer any questions. I can also turn it over to Ms. Hanover.
Do either of my colleagues have questions? I have one question. I noticed your background there is snow. Is that a snow background, or has it gotten colder in San Diego than I think it is?
I'm coming to you from Anchorage, Alaska today.
So. There you go. Okay.
Yeah, so but my sunrise is a little bit later, and my outdoors is we have big single digits. So I'm feeling the cold blast like everybody else.
Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hanover, it's turn over to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Holly Hanover, on behalf of Mr. Diaz, I want to join in the arguments made by Mr. Marks. And I just have a couple of brief additions to that, just to drive the points home that he wanted to make as well. It's our position that 3553F1 is unambiguous and it reads conjunctively. There's nothing absurd about reading the word and in the conjunctive in this case. The First Step Act was expanded to improve the eligibility for safety valve, and the conjunctive reading of that goes right along and is entirely consistent with that intent. In fact, to do so is grammatically and logically the norm, especially when the list involves a list of negative prohibitions, as it does in this case, according to Scalia and Brian Gardner, in their description of how to read certain aspects of legislation. This argument is also supported by the fact that 3553F in general also uses the same conjunctive construction as Section 3553F1. So to basically argue that this part of the statute should read the exact opposite of the rest of the statute would be absurd, in our opinion. The drafters of this particular subsection had every opportunity to use the word or and could have easily done so, because it's pretty clear from the remainder of the statute they used the word or several times, but declined to do so within the section 3553F1. And I think that says a lot about the statute and the construction of it. And finally, I wanted to leave the court with this quote from Judge Gorsuch from the recent case of the last Supreme Court term. When the express terms of a statute gives us one answer and extra textual considerations suggest another, it's no contest. Only the written word is law. And that's our position on this case, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do either of my colleagues have any questions for Ms. Hanover? Very well. No. Thanks to both counsel for the defendants. Mr. Zip, you have a little rebuttal time. We're going to give you a couple of minutes to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, in Griffin versus Oceanic Contractors, the Supreme Court said that interpretations of a statute that would produce absurd results are to be avoided if alternate interpretations consistent with the legislative purpose are available. And what we have proposed in our brief is an alternate interpretation, and that's one that reads the words "does not have" before the M dash at the beginning of the statute to modify each of the three following subsections, so that a defendant is precluded from safety valve relief if he does not have more than 4 criminal history points, does not have a 3-point offense, and does not have a prior 2-point violent felony offense. That reading would eliminate the absurdity that Judge Boggs noted of a Bernie Madoff type figure still qualifying, that the court noticed in Adame, of someone that qualified as a criminal career offender qualifying. And it would eliminate the problem of a similarly situated defendant with one serious felony offense and a misdemeanor violent offense not qualifying, while that same defendant, if he had a more serious violent offense, would qualify.
But counsel, you're clearly asking us to rewrite the statute, are you not?
We're asking this court to interpret "and" as "or," as this court has done many times in the past. And to look at the various canons of interpretation and to sort of essentially read it as a disjunctive. Whether that's rewriting or interpreting, I think, doesn't really matter at the end of the day. What we're saying is that the rule against surplusage, the rule against an absurd interpretation, and the legislative history that there is all support the sort of relatively easy lift, as this court has recognized, of interpreting "and" as "or" when that's plainly what Congress intended.
But what's your response to Ms. Hanover's quotation from Justice Gorsuch in terms of how we read statute?
I would just go back to the same points, that this unique problem here of "and" meaning or meaning "and" is one that this court has recognized for 150 years.
That would also be true of the meaning of the word "sex" and the Civil Rights Act of 1964, would it not?
It could be, but I don't know that rule necessarily applies to every word and every case, that simply reading the plain language is the end of the analysis, as this court has held many times.
But I do, if I understood you correctly before, you agree that if applying all of the canons of construction, we conclude that the statute is ambiguous, that then the rule of lenity would apply.
It's more than that. I think this court would have to conclude that it's grievously ambiguous and that it has to simply guess at what Congress meant in this case. And for all the reasons that we've outlined, this interpretation simply doesn't reach to that level. So we'd ask that you adopt the alternate construction that applies the does not have to each of the subsections and limit the reach of this amendment.
Alternative facts, right?
It's an alternative interpretation. I think okay. We all agree on the facts here.
All right. Do any of my colleagues have any additional questions for the government? We thank all counsel for your argument in this interesting case. We recognize this is an interesting and important problem since safety valve considerations involve almost all criminal sentencing issues. So thank you very much. The case just argued is submitted, and the court stands adjourned for the day.